event, and this form progresses till the centre of emotional gravity is equidistant from the artist himself and from others. The narrative is no longer purely personal. The personality of the artist passes into the narration itself, flowing round and round the persons and the action like a vital sea. This progress you will see easily in that old English ballad, Turpin Hero, which begins in the first person and ends in the third person. The dramatic form is reached when the vitality which has flowed and eddied round each person fills every person with such vital force that he or she assumes a proper and intangible aesthetic life. The personality of the artist, at first a cry or a cadence or a mood, and then a fluid and lambent narrative, finally refines itself out of existence, impersonalizes itself, so to speak. The aesthetic image in the dramatic form is life purified in and reprojected from the human imagination. The mystery of aesthetic, like that of material creation, is accomplished. The artist, like the god of creation, remains within or behind or beyond or above his handiwork, invisible, refined out of existence, indifferent, paring his fingernails. "Trying to refine them also out of existence," said Lynch. A fine rain began to fall from the high-veiled sky, and they turned into the Duke's lawn to reach the National Library before the shower came. "What do you mean?" Lynch asked surlily. "By prating about beauty and the imagination in this miserable godforsaken island. No wonder the artist retired within or behind his handiwork after having perpetrated this country." The rain fell faster. When they passed through the passage beside Kildare House, they found many students sheltering under the arcade of the library. Cranley, leaning against a pillar, was picking his teeth with a sharpened match, listening to some companions. Some girls stood near the entrance door. Lynch whispered to Stephen, "Your beloved is here." Stephen took his place silently on the step below the group of students, heedless of the rain which fell fast, turning his eyes towards her from time to time. She too stood silently among her companions. She has no priest to flirt with, he thought with conscious bitterness, remembering how he had seen her last. Lynch was right. His mind, emptied of theory and courage, lapsed back into a listless peace. He heard the students talking among themselves. They spoke of two friends who had passed the final medical examination, of the chances of getting places on ocean liners, of poor and rich practices. "That's all a bubble. An Irish country practices better. Hines was 2 years in Liverpool, and he says the same. A frightful hole, he said it was. Nothing but midwifery cases. Do you mean to say it is better to have a job here in the country than in a rich city like that? I know a fella. Hines has no brains. He's got through by stewing, pure stewing. Ah, don't mind him. There's plenty of money to be made in a big commercial city. Depends on the practice. Ego credo ut vita pauperum est simpliciter atrox, simpliciter sanguiner eos atrox, in Liverpoolio." Their voices reached his ears, as if from a distance in interrupted pulsation. She was preparing to go away with her companions. The quick, light shower had drawn off, tarring in clusters of diamonds among the shrubs of the quadrangle, where an exhalation was breathed forth by the blackened earth. Their trim boots prattled as they stood on the steps of the colonnade, talking quietly and gaily, glancing at the clouds, holding their umbrellas at cunning angles against the few last raindrops, closing them again, holding their skirts demurely. And if he had judged her harshly? If her life were a simple rosary of hours, her life simple and strange as a bird's life, gay in the morning, restless all day, tired at sundown, her heart simple and willful as a bird's heart? Towards dawn he awoke. Oh, what sweet music. His soul was all dewy wet. Over his limbs in sleep, pale cool waves of light had passed. He lay still, as if his soul lay amid cool waters, conscious of faint, sweet music. His mind was waking slowly to a tremulous morning knowledge, a morning inspiration. A spirit filled him, pure as the purest water, sweet as dew, moving as music. But how faintly it was inbreathed. How passionlessly, as if the seraphim themselves were breathing upon him. his soul was waking slowly, fearing to awake wholly. It was that windless hour of dawn when madness wakes and strange plants open to the light and the moth flies forth silently. An enchantment of the heart. The night had been enchanted. In a dream or vision he had known the ecstasy of seraphic life. Was it an instant of enchantment only, or long hours and years and ages? The instant of inspiration seemed now to be reflected from all sides at once from a multitude of cloudy circumstances of what had happened or of what might have happened. The instant flashed forth like a point of light, and now from cloud on cloud of vague circumstances, confused form was veiling softly its afterglow. Oh! In the virgin womb of the imagination, the word was made flesh. Gabriel the Seraph had come to the Virgin's chamber. An afterglow deepened within his spirit, whence the white flame had passed, deepening to a rose and ardent light. That rose and ardent light was her strange, willful heart, strange that no man had known or would know, willful from before the beginning of the world, and lured by that ardent rose-like glow, the choirs of the seraphim were falling from heaven. Are you not weary of ardent ways, lure of the fallen seraphim? Tell no more of enchanted days. The verses passed from his mind to his lips, and murmuring them over, he felt the rhythmic movement of a villanelle pass through them. The rose-like glow sent forth its rays of rhyme, ways, days, blaze, praise, rays. Its rays burned up the world, consumed the hearts of men and angels, the rays from the rose that was her willful heart. Your eyes have set man's heart ablaze, and you have had your will of him. Are you not weary of ardent ways? And then? The rhythm died away, ceased, began again to move and beat, and then? Smoke, incense, ascending from the altar of the world. Above the flame, the smoke of praise goes from ocean, rim to rim. Tell no more of enchanted days. Smoke went up from the whole earth, from the vapory oceans, smoke of her praise. The earth was like a swinging, swaying censer, a ball of incense, an ellipsoidal fall. The rhythm died out at once, the cry of his heart was broken. His lips began to murmur the first verses over and over, then went on stumbling through half verses, stammering and baffled, then stopped. The heart's cry was broken. The veiled, windless hour had passed, and behind the panes of the naked window the morning light was gathering. A bell beat, faintly, very far away. A bird twittered, two birds, three. The bell and the bird ceased, and the dull white light spread itself east and west, covering the world, covering the rose light in his heart. Fearing to lose all, he raised himself suddenly on his elbow to look for paper and pencil. There was neither on the table, only the soup plate he had eaten the rice from for supper and the candlestick with its tendrils of tallow and its paper socket singed by the last flame. He stretched his arm warily towards the foot of the bed, groping with his hand in the pockets of the coat that hung there. His fingers found a pencil, and then a cigarette packet. He lay back down, tearing open the packet, placed the last cigarette on the window ledge, and began to write out the stanzas of the villanelle in small, neat letters on the rough cardboard surface. Having written them out, he lay back on the lumpy pillow, murmuring them again. The lumps of knotted flock under his head reminded him of the lumps of knotted horsehair in the sofa of her parlour, on which he used to sit, smiling or serious, asking himself why he had come, displeased with her and with himself, confounded by the print of the sacred heart above the untenanted sideboard. He saw her approach him in a lull of the talk and beg him to sing one of his curious songs. Then he saw himself sitting at the old piano, striking chords softly from its speckled keys and singing, amid the talk which had risen again in the room, to her who leaned beside the mantelpiece, a dainty song of the Elizabethans, a sad and sweet loth to depart, the victory chant of Agincourt, the happy air of Greensleeves. While he sang and she listened, or feigned to listen, his heart was at rest. But when the quaint old songs had ended and he heard again the voices in the room, he remembered his own sarcasm. The house where young men are called by their Christian names a little too soon. At certain instants, her eyes seemed about to trust him, but he had waited in vain. She passed now dancing lightly across his memory as she had been that night at the carnival ball, her white dress a little lifted, a white spray nodding in her hair. She danced lightly in the round. She was dancing towards him, and as she came, her eyes were a little averted and a faint glow was on her cheek. At the pause in the chain of hands, her hand had lain in his an instant, a soft merchandise. "You are a great stranger now." "Yes. I was born to be a monk. I'm afraid you are a heretic." "Are you much afraid?" For answer, she had danced away from him along the chain of hands, dancing lightly and discreetly, giving herself to none. The white spray nodded to her dancing, and when she was in shadow, the glow was deeper on her cheek. A monk. His own image started forth, a profaner of the cloister. A heretic, Franciscan, willing and willing not to serve. Spinning like Gherardino de Borgo San Donino, a lithe web of sophistry and whispering in her ear. No, it was not his image. It was like the image of the young priest in whose company he had seen her last, looking at him out of dove's eyes, toying with the pages of her Irish phrasebook. "Yes, yes, the ladies are coming round to us. I can see it every day. The ladies are with us, the best helpers the language has. And the church, Father Moran. The church too. Coming round too. The work is going ahead there too. Don't fret about the church." "Bah." He had done well to leave the room in disdain. He had done well not to salute her on the steps of the library. He had done well to leave her to flirt with her priest, to toy with a church which was the scullery maid of Christendom. Rude, brutal anger routed the last lingering instant of ecstasy from his soul. It broke up violently her fair image and flung the fragments on all sides. On all sides, distorted reflections of her image started from his memory, the flower girl in the ragged dress with damp coarse hair and a hoyden's face who had called herself his own girl and begged his Hansel. The kitchen girl in the next house who sang over the clatter of her plates with the drawl of a country singer, the first bars of "By Killarney's Lakes and Fells." A girl who had laughed gaily to see him stumble when the iron grating in the footpath near Cork Hill had caught the broken sole of his shoe. A girl he had glanced at, attracted by her small, ripe mouth, as she passed out of Jacob's biscuit factory, who had cried to him over her shoulder, "Do you like what you're seeing of me? Straight hair and curly eyebrows." And yet he felt that however he might revile and mock her image, his anger was also a form of homage. He had left the classroom in disdain that was not wholly sincere, feeling that perhaps the secret of her race lay behind those dark eyes upon which her long lashes flung a quick shadow. He had told himself bitterly as he walked through the streets that she was a figure of the womanhood of her country, a bat-like soul waking to the consciousness of itself in darkness and secrecy and loneliness, tarrying a while, loveless and sinless, with her mild lover and leaving him to whisper of innocent transgressions in the latticed ear of a priest. His anger against her found vent in coarse railing at her paramour, whose name and voice and features offended his baffled pride. A priested peasant, with a brother a policeman in Dublin and a brother a potboy in Moycullen. To him she would unveil her soul's shy nakedness, to one who was but schooled in the discharging of a formal rite rather than to him, priest of the eternal imagination, transmuting the daily bread of experience into the radiant body of ever-living life. The radiant image of the Eucharist united again in an instant his bitter and despairing thoughts, their cries arising unbroken in a hymn of thanksgiving. Our broken cries and mournful lays rise in one Eucharistic hymn. Are you not weary of ardent ways? While sacrificing hands upraise the chalice flowing to the brim, tell no more of enchanted days. He spoke the verses aloud from the first lines till the music and rhythm suffused his mind, turning it to quiet indulgence, then copied them painfully to feel them the better by seeing them, then lay back on his bolster. The full morning light had come. No sound was to be heard. But he knew that all around him life was about to awaken in common noises, hoarse voices, sleepy prayers. Shrinking from that life, he turned towards the wall, making a cowl of the blanket and staring at the great, overblown scarlet flowers of the tattered wallpaper. He tried to warm his perishing joy in their secret glow, imagining a roseway from where he lay upwards to heaven, all strewn with scarlet flowers. Weary. Weary. He too was weary of ardent ways. A gradual warmth, a languorous weariness passed over him, descending along his spine from his closely cowled head. He felt it descend, and seeing himself as he lay, smiled. Soon he would sleep. He had written verses for her again after 10 years, 10 years before she had worn her shawl cowl-wise about her head, sending sprays of her warm breath into the night air, tapping her foot upon the glassy road. It was the last tram. The lank brown horses knew it and shook their bells to the clear night in admonition. The conductor talked with the driver, both nodding often in the green light of the lamp. They stood on the steps of the tram, he on the upper, she on the lower. She came up to his step many times between their phrases and went down again, and once or twice remained beside him, forgetting to go down, and then went down. Let be. Let be. 10 years from that wisdom of children to his folly. If he sent her the verses, they would be read out at breakfast amid the tapping of eggshells, folly indeed. Her brothers would laugh and try to wrest the page from each other with her strong, hard fingers. The suave priest, her uncle, seated in his armchair, would hold the page at arm's length, read it smiling, and approve of the literary form. No, no, that was folly. Even if he sent her the verses, she would not show them to others. No. No, she could not. He began to feel that he had wronged her. A sense of her innocence moved him almost to pity her. An innocence he had never understood till he had come to the knowledge of it through sin. An innocence which she too had not understood while she was innocent or before the strange humiliation of her nature had first come upon her. Then first her soul had begun to live, as his soul had when he had first sinned. And a tender compassion filled his heart as he remembered her frail pallor and her eyes, humbled and saddened by the dark shame of womanhood. While his soul had passed from ecstasy to languor, where had she been? Might it be in the mysterious ways of spiritual life that her soul at those same moments had been conscious of his homage? It might be. A glow of desire kindled again his soul and fired and fulfilled all his body. Conscious of his desire, she was waking from odorous sleep, the temptress of his villanelle. Her eyes, dark and with a look of languor, were opening to his. Her nakedness yielded to him, radiant, warm, odorous, and lavish-limbed, enfolded him like a shining cloud, enfolded him like water with a liquid life, and like a cloud of vapor, like water circumfluent in space, the liquid letters of speech, symbols of the element of mystery, flowed forth over his brain. Are you not weary of ardent ways, lure of the fallen seraphim? Tell no more of enchanted days. Your eyes have set man's heart ablaze, and you have had your will of him. Are you not weary of ardent ways? Above the flame the smoke of praise goes up from ocean rim to rim. Tell no more of enchanted days. Our broken cries and mournful lays rise in one Eucharistic hymn. Are you not weary of ardent ways? While sacrificing hands upraise the chalice flowing to the brim, tell no more of enchanted days. And still you hold our longing gaze with languorous look and lavish limb. Are you not weary of ardent ways? Tell no more of enchanted days. What birds were they? He stood on the steps of the library to look at them, leaning wearily on his ash plant. They flew round and round the jutting shoulder of a house on Molesworth Street. The air of the late March evening made clear their flight, their dark quivering bodies flying clearly against the sky, as against a limp hung cloth of smoky, tenuous blue. He watched their flight. Bird after bird, a dark flash, a swerve, a flutter of wings. He tried to count them before all their darting, quivering bodies passed, 6, 10, 11, and wondered were they odd or even in number. 12, 13, for two came wheeling down from the upper sky. They were flying high and low, but ever round and round in straight and curving lines, and ever flying from left to right, circling about a temple of air. He listened to the cries, like the squeak of mice behind the wainscot, a shrill twofold note. But the notes were long and shrill and whirring, unlike the cry of vermin, falling a third or a fourth, and trilled as the flying beaks clove the air. Their cry was shrill and clear and fine, and falling like threads of silken light, unwound from whirring pools. The inhuman clamour soothed his ears, in which his mother's sobs and reproaches murmured insistently, and the dark, frail, quivering bodies wheeling and fluttering and swerving round an airy temple of the tenuous sky soothed his eyes, which still saw the image of his mother's face. Why was he gazing upwards from the steps of the porch, hearing their shrill twofold cry, watching their flight? For an augury of good or evil? A phrase of Cornelius Agrippa flew through his mind, and then there flew hither and thither shapeless thoughts from Swedenborg on the correspondence of birds to things of the intellect, and of how the creatures of the air have their knowledge and know their times and seasons because they, unlike man, are in the order of their life and have not perverted that order by reason. And for ages man had gazed upward as he was gazing at birds in flight. The colonnade above him made him think vaguely of an ancient temple, and the ash plant on which he leaned warily of the curved stick of an augur. A sense of fear of the unknown moved in the heart of his weariness, a fear of symbols and portents, of the hawk-like man whose name he bore soaring out of his captivity on osier-woven wings, of Thoth, the god of writers, writing with a reed upon a tablet, and bearing on his narrow ibis head the cusped moon. He smiled as he thought of the god's image, for it made him think of a bottle-nosed judge in a wig, putting commas into a document which he held at arm's length, and he knew that he would not have remembered the god's name, but that it was like an Irish oath. It was folly. But was it for this folly that he was about to leave forever the house of prayer and prudence into which he had been born and the order of life out of which he had come? They came back with shrill cries over the jutting shoulder of the house, flying darkly against the fading air. What birds were they? He thought that they must be swallows who had come back from the south. Then he was to go away, for they were birds ever going and coming, building ever an unlasting home under the eaves of men's houses, and ever leaving the homes they had built to wander. Bend down your faces, Una and Alil. I gaze upon them as the swallow gazes, upon the nest under the eave before he wander the loud waters. A soft liquid joy like the noise of many waters flowed over his memory, and he felt in his heart the soft peace of silent spaces, of fading, tenuous sky above the waters, of oceanic silence, of swallows flying through the sea dusk over the flowing waters. A soft liquid joy flowed through the words where the soft long vowels hurtled noiselessly and fell away, lapping and flowing back, and ever shaking the white bells of their waves in mute chime and mute peal and soft, low, swooning cry. And he felt that the augury he had sought in the wheeling, darting birds and in the pale space of sky above him had come forth from his heart like a bird from a turret, quietly and swiftly. Symbol of departure or of loneliness? The verses crooned in the ear of his memory composed slowly before his remembering eyes the scene of the hall on the night of the opening of the National Theatre. He was alone at the side of the balcony, looking out of jaded eyes at the culture of Dublin in the stalls and at the tawdry scene cloths and human dolls framed by the garish lamps of the stage. A burly policeman sweated behind him and seemed at every moment about to act. The catcalls and hisses and mocking cries ran in rude gusts round the hall from his scattered fellow students.
A libel on Ireland! Made in Germany! Blasphemy! We never sold our faith. No Irish woman ever did it. We want no amateur atheists. We want no budding Buddhists.
A sudden, swift hiss fell from the windows above him, and he knew that the electric lamps had been switched on in the reader's room. He turned into the pillared hall, now calmly lit, went up the staircase and passed in through the clicking turnstile. Cranley was sitting over near the dictionaries. A thick book opened at the frontispiece lay before him on the wooden rest. He leaned back in his chair, inclining his ear like that of a confessor to the face of the medical student who was reading to him, a problem from the chess page of a journal. Stephen sat down at his right, and the priest at the other side of the table closed his copy of the tablet with an angry snap and stood up. Cranley gazed after him blandly and vaguely. The medical student went on in a softer voice.
Pawns to King Forth.
We had better go, Dixon, said Stephen in warning. He's gone to complain. Dixon folded the journal and rose with dignity, saying,
Our men retired in good order.
With guns and cattle, added Stephen, pointing to the title page of Cranley's book on which was printed Diseases of the Ox. As they passed through a lane of the tables, Stephen said, Cranley, I want to speak to you. Cranley did not answer or turn. He laid his book on the counter and passed out, his well-shod feet sounding flatly on the floor. On the staircase he paused and, gazing absently at Dixon, repeated,
Pawn to King's bloody fort.
Put it that way if you like, Dixon said. He had a quiet, toneless voice and urbane manners, and on a finger of his plump, clean hand he displayed at moments a signet ring. As they crossed the hall, a man of dwarfish stature came towards them. Under the dome of his tiny hat, his unshaven face began to smile with pleasure, and he was heard to murmur. The eyes were melancholy as those of a monkey.
Good evening, gentlemen, said the stubble-grown monkeyish face.
Warm weather for March, said Cranley. They have the windows open upstairs.
Dixon smiled and turned his ring. The blackish, monkey-puckered face pursed its human mouth with gentle pleasure, and its voice purred.
Delightful weather for March. Simply delightful.
There are two nice young ladies upstairs, Captain. Tired of waiting, Dixon said.
Cranley smiled and said kindly, The Captain has only one love, Sir Walter Scott. Isn't that so, Captain?
What are you reading now, Captain? Dixon asked. The Bride of Lammermoor?
I love old Scott, the flexible lips said. I think he writes something lovely. There is no writer can touch Sir Walter Scott.
He moved a thin, shrunken brown hand gently in the air in time to his praise, and his thin, quick eyelids beat often over his sad eyes. Sadder to Stephen's ear was his speech, a genteel accent, low and moist, marred by errors, and listening to it he wondered was the story true, and was the thin blood that flowed in his shrunken frame noble and come of an incestuous love? The park trees were heavy with rain. The rain fell still and ever in the lake, lying grey like a shield. A game of swans flew there, and the water and the shore beneath were fouled with their green-white slime. They embraced softly, impelled by the grey rainy night, the wet silent trees, the shield-like witnessing lake, the swans. They embraced without joy or passion, his arm about his sister's neck. A grey woolen cloak was wrapped athwart her, from her shoulder to her waist, and her fair head was bent in willing shame. He had loose red-brown hair and tender, shapely, strong, freckled hands. Face? There was no face seen. The brother's face was bent upon her fair, rain-fragrant hair. The hand, freckled and strong and shapely, caressing, was Davin's hand. He frowned angrily upon his thought, and on the shriveled mannequin who had called it forth. His father's jibes at the Bantry gang leaped out of his memory. He held them at a distance and brooded uneasily on his own thought again. Why were they not Cranley's hands? Had Davin's simplicity and innocence stung him more secretly? He walked on across the hall with Dixon, leaving Cranley to take leave elaborately of the dwarf. Under the colonnade, Temple was standing in the midst of a little group of students. One of them cried,
Dixon, come over till you hear. Temple is in grand form.
Temple turned on him his dark gypsy eyes.
You're a hypocrite, O'Keefe, he said, and Dixon is a smiler. By hell, I think that's a good literary expression.
He laughed slyly, looking in Stephen's face, repeating,
By hell, I'm delighted with that name, a smiler.
A stout student who stood below them on the steps said,
Come back to the mistress, Temple. We want to hear about that.
He had faith, Temple said, and he was a married man too, and all the priests used to be dining there. By hell, I think they all had a touch.
We should call it riding a hack to spare the hunter, said Dixon.
Tell us, Temple, O'Keefe said. How many quarts of porter have you in you?
All your intellectual soul is in that phrase, O'Keefe, said Temple with open scorn.
He moved with a shambling gait round the group and spoke to Stephen.
Did you know that the Forsters are the kings of Belgium? He asked.
Cranley came out through the door of the entrance hall, his hat thrust back on the nape of his neck,
and picking his teeth with care.
"And here's the Wiseacre," said Temple. "Do you know that about the Forsters?"
He paused for an answer. Cranley dislodged a fig seed from his teeth on the point of his rude toothpick and gazed at it intently.
"The Forster family," Temple said, "is descended from Baldwin the First, King of Flanders. He was called the Forester. Forester and Forster are the same name. A descendant of Baldwin the First, Captain Francis Forster, settled in Ireland and married the daughter of the last chieftain of Clanbrassil. Then there are the Blake Forsters. That's a different branch."
"From Baldhead, King of Flanders," Cranley repeated, rooting again deliberately in his gleaming uncovered teeth.
"Where did you pick up all that history?" O'Keefe asked.
"I know all the history of your family too," Temple said, turning to Stephen. "Do you know what Giraldus Cambrensis says about your family?"
"Is he descended from Baldwin too?"
asked a tall, consumptive student with dark eyes.
"Baldhead," Cranley repeated, sucking at a crevice in his teeth.
"Per nobilis et ver pertusta familia,"
Temple said to Stephen. The stout student who stood below them on the steps farted briefly. Dixon turned towards him, saying in a soft voice,
"Did an angel speak?"
Cranley turned also and said vehemently, but without anger,
"Goggins, you're the flamingest dirty devil I ever met, do you know?"
"I had it on my mind to say that," Goggins answered firmly. "It did no one any harm, did it?"
"We hope," Dixon said suavely, "that it was not of the kind known to science as a Paolo post futurum."
"Didn't I tell you he was a smiler?" said Temple, turning right and left. "Didn't I give him that name?"
"You did. We're not deaf," said the tall consumptive. Cranley still frowned at the stout student below him. Then, with a snort of disgust, he shoved him violently down the steps.
"Go away from here," he said rudely. "Go away, you stinkpot. And you are a stinkpot."
Goggins skipped down onto the gravel and at once returned to his place with good humour. Temple turned back to Stephen and asked,
"Do you believe in the law of heredity?"
"Are you drunk, or what are you trying to say?" asked Cranley, facing round on him with an expression of wonder.
"The most profound sentence ever written," Temple said with enthusiasm, "is the sentence at the end of the zoology. Reproduction is the beginning of death."
He touched Stephen timidly at the elbow and said eagerly,
"Do you feel how profound that is because you are a poet?"
Cranley pointed his long forefinger. "Look at him," he said with scorn to the others. "Look at Ireland's hope."
They laughed at his words and gesture. Temple turned on him bravely, saying,
"Cranley, you're always sneering at me. I can see that. But I am as good as you any day. Do you know what I think about you now as compared with myself?"
"My dear man," said Cranley urbanely, "you are incapable, do you know, absolutely incapable of thinking."
"But do you know," Temple went on, "what I think of you and of myself compared together?"
"Out with it, Temple," the stout student cried from the steps. "Get it out in bits."
Temple turned right and left, making sudden feeble gestures as he spoke.
"I'm a bollocks," he said, shaking his head in despair. "I am, and I know I am, and I admit it that I am."
Dixon patted him lightly on the shoulder and said mildly, "And it does you every credit, Temple."
"But he," Temple said, pointing to Cranley, "he is a bollocks too, like me, only he doesn't know it. And that's the only difference I see."
A burst of laughter covered his words, but he turned again to Stephen and said with a sudden eagerness,
"That word is a most interesting word. That's the only English dual number, do you know?"
"Is it?" Stephen said vaguely. He was watching Cranley's firm-featured, suffering face lit up now by a smile of false patience. The gross name had passed over it like foul water poured over an old stone image, patient of injuries. And, as he watched him, he saw him raise his hat in salute and uncover the black hair that stood stiffly from his forehead like an iron crown. She passed out from the porch of the library and bowed across Stephen in reply to Cranley's greeting. He also? Was there not a slight flush on Cranley's cheek? Or had it come forth at Temple's words? The light had waned. He could not see. Did that explain his friend's listless silence, his harsh comments, the sudden intrusions of rude speech with which he had shattered so often Stephen's ardent, wayward confessions? Stephen had forgiven freely, for he had found this rudeness also in himself. And he remembered an evening when he had dismounted from a borrowed creaking bicycle to pray to God in a wood near Malahide. He had lifted up his arms and spoken in ecstasy to the sombre nave of the trees, knowing that he stood on holy ground and in a holy hour. And when two constabulary men had come into sight round a bend in the gloomy road, he had broken off his prayer to whistle loudly an air from the last pantomime. He began to beat the frayed end of his ash plant against the base of a pillar. Had Cranley not heard him? Yet he could wait. The talk about him ceased for a moment, and a soft hiss fell again from a window above. But no other sound was in the air, and the swallows whose flight he had followed with idle eyes were sleeping. She had passed through the dusk, and therefore the air was silent save for one soft hiss that fell. And therefore the tongues about him had ceased their babble. Darkness was falling. Darkness falls from the air. A trembling joy, lambent as a faint light, played like a fairy host around him. But why? Her passage through the darkening air, or the verse with its black vowels and its opening sound rich and lute-like? He walked away slowly towards the deeper shadows at the end of the colonnade, beating the stone softly with his stick to hide his reverie from the students whom he had left, and allowed his mind to summon back to itself the age of Doland and Bird and Nash. Eyes opening from the darkness of desire, eyes that dimmed the breaking east. What was their languid grace but the softness of chambering? And what was their shimmer but the shimmer of the scum that mantled the cesspool of the court of a slobbering steward? And he tasted in the language of memory ambered wines, dying fallings of sweet airs, the proud pavan, and saw with the eyes of memory kind, gentle women in Covent Garden wooing from their balconies with sucking mouths and the pox-fouled wenches of the taverns and young wives that gaily yielding to their ravishers clipped and clipped again. The images he had summoned gave him no pleasure. They were secret and inflaming, but her image was not entangled by them. That was not the way to think of her. It was not even the way in which he thought of her. Could his mind then not trust itself? Old phrases sweet, only with a disinterred sweetness like the fig seeds Cranley rooted out of his gleaming teeth. It was not thought, nor vision, though he knew vaguely that her figure was passing homeward through the city. Vaguely first, and then more sharply, he smelt her body. A conscious unrest seethed in his blood. Yes, it was her body he smelt. A wild and languid smell, the tepid limbs over which his music had flowed desirously, and the secret soft linen upon which her flesh distilled odour and a dew. A louse crawled over the nape of his neck, and putting his thumb and forefinger deftly beneath his loose collar, he caught it. He rolled its body, tender yet brittle as a grain of rice, between thumb and finger for an instant before he let it fall from him and wondered would it live or die. There came to his mind a curious phrase from Cornelius a Lapide, which said that the lice born of human sweat were not created by God with the other animals on the sixth day, but the tickling of the skin of his neck made his mind raw and red. The life of his body, ill-clad, ill-fed, louse-eaten, made him close his eyelids in a sudden spasm of despair, and in the darkness he saw the brittle, bright bodies of lice falling from the air and turning often as they fell. Yes, and it was not darkness that fell from the air. It was brightness. Brightness falls from the air. He had not even remembered rightly Nash's line. All the images it had awakened were false. His mind bred vermin. His thoughts were lice born of the sweat of sloth. He came back quickly along the colonnade towards the group of students. Well then, let her go and be damned to her. She could love some clean athlete who washed himself every morning to the waist and had black hair in his chest. Let her. Cranley had taken another dried fig from the supply in his pocket and was eating it slowly and noisily. Temple sat on the pediment of a pillar, leaning back, his cap pulled down on his sleepy eyes. A squat young man came out of the porch, a leather portfolio tucked under his armpit. He marched towards the group, striking the flags with the heels of his boots and with the ferrule of his heavy umbrella. Then, raising the umbrella in salute, he said to all, "Good evening, sirs." He struck the flags again and tittered while his head trembled with a slight nervous movement. The tall consumptive student and Dixon and O'Keefe were speaking in Irish and did not answer him. Then turning to Cranley, he said, "Good evening particularly to you." He moved the umbrella in indication and tittered again. Cranley, who was still chewing the fig, answered with loud movements of his jaws.
Good. Yes. It is a good evening.
The squat student looked at him seriously and shook his umbrella gently and reprovingly. I can see, he said, that you are about to make obvious remarks. Cranley answered, holding out what remained of the half-chewed fig and jerking it towards the squat student's mouth in sign that he should eat. The squat student did not eat it, but indulging his special humour, said gravely, still tittering and prodding his phrase with his umbrella, Do you intend that? He broke off, pointed bluntly to the munched pulp of the fig and said loudly, I allude to that. Cranley said as before. Do you intend that now? The squat student said. As ipso facto, or, let us say, as so to speak. Dixon turned aside from his group, saying, Goggins was waiting for you, Glynn. He's gone around to the Adelphi to look for you and Moynihan. What have you there? He asked, tapping the portfolio under Glynn's arm. Examination papers, Glynn answered. I give them monthly examinations to see that they are profiting by my tuition. He also tapped the portfolio and coughed gently and smiled.
Tuition, said Cranley rudely. I suppose you mean the barefooted children that are taught by a bloody ape like you. God help them.
He bit off the rest of the fig and flung away the butt. I suffer little children to come unto me, Glynn said amiably.
A bloody ape, Cranley repeated with emphasis, and a blasphemous bloody ape.
Temple stood up and, pushing past Cranley, addressed Glynn.
That phrase you said now, he said, is from the New Testament about suffer the children to come to me.
Go to sleep again, Temple, said O'Keefe.
Very well then, Temple continued, still addressing Glynn. And if Jesus suffered the children to come, why does the church send them all to hell if they die unbaptized? Why is that?
Were you baptized yourself, Temple? The consumptive student asked.
But why are they sent to hell if Jesus said they were all to come?
Temple said, his eyes searching Glynn's eyes. Glynn coughed and said gently, holding back with difficulty the nervous titter in his voice and moving his umbrella at every word. And as you remark, if it is thus, I ask emphatically, whence comes this thusness?
Because the church is cruel like all old sinners, Temple said.
Are you quite orthodox on that point, Temple? Dixon said suavely.
St. Augustine says that about unbaptized children going to hell, Temple answered, because he was a cruel old sinner too.
Why, I bow to you, Dixon said, but I had the impression that limbo existed for such cases.
Don't argue with them, Dixon, Cranley said brutally. Don't talk to him or look at him. Lead him home with a sugan the way you'd lead a bleating goat.
Limbo, cried Temple. That's a fine invention too, like hell. But with the unpleasantness left out, Dixon said. He turned, smiling to the others, and said, I think I am voicing the opinions of all present in saying so much.
You are,
Glynn said in a firm tone. On that point, Ireland is united. He struck the ferrule of his umbrella on the stone floor of the colonnade.
Hell, Temple said. I can respect that invention of the grey spouse of Satan. Hell is Roman, like the walls of the Romans, strong and ugly. But what is limbo?
Put him back into the perambulator, Cranley, O'Keefe called out. Cranley made a swift step towards Temple, halted, stamping his foot, crying as if to a fowl.
Hush!
Temple moved away nimbly.
Do you know what limbo is? He cried. Do you know what we call a notion like that in Roscommon?
Hush! Blast you! Cranley cried, clapping his hands.
Neither my arse nor my elbow, Temple cried out scornfully. And that's what I call limbo.
Give us that stick here, Cranley said.
He snatched the ash plant roughly from Stephen's hand and sprang down the steps, but Temple, hearing him move in pursuit, fled through the dusk like a wild creature, nimble and fleet-footed. Cranley's heavy boots were heard loudly charging across the quadrangle, and then returning heavily, foiled and spurning the gravel at each step. His step was angry, and with an angry, abrupt gesture, he thrust the stick back into Stephen's hand. Stephen felt that his anger had another cause, but, feigning patience, touched his arm slightly and said quietly,
Cranley, I told you I wanted to speak to you. Come away.
Cranley looked at him for a few moments and asked,
Now?
Yes, now, Stephen said. We can't speak here. Come away.
They crossed the quadrangle together without speaking. The bird call from Siegfried whistled softly, followed them from the steps of the porch. Cranley turned, and Dixon, who had whistled, called out,
Where are you fellows off to?
What about that game, Cranley?
They parlayed in shouts across the still air about a game of billiards to be played in the Adelphi Hotel. Stephen walked on alone and out into the quiet of Kildare Street opposite Maple's Hotel. He stood to wait, patient again. The name of the hotel, a colourless polished wood, and its colourless front stung him like a lance of polite disdain. He stared angrily back at the softly lit drawing room of the hotel in which he imagined the sleek lives of the patricians of Ireland housed in calm. They thought of army commissions and land agents. Peasants greeted them along the roads in the country. They knew the names of certain French dishes and gave orders to Jarvies in high-pitched provincial voices, which pierced through their skin-tight accents. How could he hit their conscience or how cast his shadow over the imaginations of their daughters, before their squires begat upon them, that they might breed a race less ignoble than their own? And under the deepened dusk he felt the thoughts and desires of the race to which he belonged, flitting like bats across the dark country lanes, under trees, by the edges of streams, and near the pool-mottled bogs. A woman had waited in the doorway as Davin had passed by at night, and offering him a cup of milk, had all but wooed him to her bed. For Davin had the mild eyes of one who could be secret, but him, no woman's eyes had wooed. His arm was taken in a strong grip, and Cranley's voice said,
"Let us let go."
They walked southward in silence. Then Cranley said,
"That blithering idiot, Temple. I swear to Moses, do you know, that I bid the death of that fellow one time."
But his voice was no longer angry, and Stephen wondered, was he thinking of her greeting to him under the porch? They turned to the left and walked on as before. When they had gone on so for some time, Stephen said, "Cranley, I had an unpleasant quarrel this evening."
"With your people?" Cranley asked.
"With my mother."
"About religion?"
"Yes," Stephen answered. After a pause, Cranley asked,
"What age is your mother?"
"Not old," Stephen said. "She wishes me to make my Easter duty."
"And will you?"
"I will not," Stephen said.
"Why not?"
Cranley said. "I will not serve," answered Stephen.
"That remark was made before,"
Cranley said calmly. "It is made behind now," Stephen said hotly. Cranley pressed Stephen's arm, saying,
"Go easy, my dear man. You're an excitable bloody man, do you know?"
He laughed nervously as he spoke and, looking up into Stephen's face with moved and friendly eyes, said,
"Do you know that you're an excitable man?"
"I dare say I am," said Stephen, laughing also. Their minds, lately estranged, seemed suddenly to have been drawn closer, one to the other.
"Do you believe in the Eucharist?" Cranley asked.
"I do not," Stephen said.
"Do you disbelieve then?"
"I neither believe in it nor disbelieve in it," Stephen answered.
"Many persons have doubts, even religious persons, yet they overcome them or put them aside," Cranley said. "Are your doubts on that point too strong?"
"I do not wish to overcome them," Stephen answered. Cranley, embarrassed for a moment, took another fig from his pocket and was about to eat it when Stephen said,
"Don't, please. You cannot discuss this question with your mouth full of chewed fig."
Cranley examined the fig by the light of a lamp under which he halted. Then he smelt it with both nostrils, bit a tiny piece, spat it out, and threw the fig rudely into the gutter. Addressing it as it lay, he said,
"Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire."
Taking Stephen's arm, he went on again and said,
"Do you not fear that those words may be spoken to you on the day of judgment?"
"What is offered me on the other hand?" Stephen asked. "An eternity of bliss in the company of the Dean of Studies?"
"Remember," Cranley said, "that he would be glorified."
"Aye," Stephen said somewhat bitterly. "Bright, agile, impassible, and above all, subtle."
"It is a curious thing, do you know," Cranley said dispassionately, "how your mind is supersaturated with the religion in which you say you disbelieve. Did you believe in it when you were at school? I bet you did."
"I did," Stephen answered.
"And were you happier then?"
Cranley asked softly.
"Happier than you are now, for instance?"
"Often happy," Stephen said. "And often unhappy." "I was someone else then."
"How someone else? What do you mean by that statement?"
"I mean," said Stephen, "that I was not myself as I am now, as I had become."
"Not as you are now, not as you had become," Cranley repeated. "Let me ask you a question.
Do you love your mother?
Stephen shook his head slowly. I don't know what your words mean, he said simply.
Have you never loved anyone? Cranley asked.
Do you mean women?
I'm not speaking of that, Cranley said in a colder tone. I ask you if you ever felt love towards anyone or anything.
Stephen walked on beside his friend, staring gloomily at the footpath. I tried to love God, he said at length. It seems now I failed. It is very difficult. I tried to unite my will with the will of God, instant by instant. In that I did not always fail. I could perhaps do that still, Cranley cut him short by asking, Has your mother had a happy life?
How do I know? Stephen said.
How many children had she?
9 or 10, Stephen answered. Some died.
Was your father? Cranley interrupted himself for an instant and then said, I don't want to pry into your family affairs, but was your father what is called well-to-do? I mean, when you were growing up.
Yes, Stephen said.
What was he? Cranley asked after a pause. Stephen began to enumerate glibly his father's attributes.
A medical student, an oarsman, a tenor, an amateur actor, a shouting politician, a small landlord, a small investor, a drinker, a good fellow, storyteller, somebody's secretary, something in a distillery, as a tax gatherer, bankrupt, and at present a praiser of his own past.
Cranley laughed, tightening his grip on Stephen's arm and said, The distillery is damn good.
Is there anything else you want to know? Stephen asked.
Are you in good circumstances at present?
Do I look it? Stephen asked bluntly.
So then, Cranley went on musingly, you were born in the lap of luxury.
He used the phrase broadly and loudly as he often used technical expressions, as if he wished his hearer to understand that they were used by him without conviction.
Your mother must have gone through a good deal of suffering, he said. Would you not try to save her from suffering more, even if... Or would you?
If I could, Stephen said. That would cost me very little.
Then do so, Cranley said. Do as she wishes you to do. What is it for you?
You disbelieve in it.
It is a form, nothing else. You will set her mind at rest.
He ceased and, as Stephen did not reply, remained silent. Then, as if giving utterance to the process of his own thought, he said,
Whatever else is unsure in this stinking dunghill of a world, a mother's love is not. Your mother brings you into the world, carries you first in her body. What do we know about what she feels? But whatever she feels, it, at least, must be real. It must be. What are our ideas, our ambitions? Play. Ideas! Why, that bloody bleating goat Temple has ideas. McCann has ideas too. Every jackass going the roads thinks he has ideas.
Stephen, who had been listening to the unspoken speech behind the words, said with assumed carelessness, Pascal, if I remember rightly, would not suffer his mother to kiss him as he feared the contact of her sex.
Pascal was a pig, said Cranley.
Aloysius Gonzaga, I think, was of the same mind, Stephen said.
And he was another pig then, said Cranley.
The church calls him a saint, Stephen objected.
I don't care a flaming damn what anyone calls him, Cranley said rudely and flatly. I call him a pig.
Stephen, preparing the words neatly in his mind, continued. Jesus, too, seems to have treated his mother with scant courtesy in public, but Suarez, a Jesuit theologian and Spanish gentleman, has apologized for him.
Did the idea ever occur to you, Cranley asked, that Jesus was not what he pretended to be?
The first person to whom that idea occurred, Stephen answered, was Jesus himself.
I mean, Cranley said, hardening in his speech, did the idea ever occur to you that he was himself a conscious hypocrite? What he called the Jews of his time a white sepulchre? Or, to put it more plainly, that he was a blackguard?
That idea never occurred to me, Stephen answered. But I'm curious to know, are you trying to make a convert of me or a pervert of yourself? He turned towards his friend's face and saw there a raw smile which some force of will strove to make finally significant.
Cranley asked suddenly, in a plain, sensible tone, Tell me the truth. Were you at all shocked by what I said?
Somewhat, Stephen said.
And why are we shocked? Cranley pressed on in the same tone. If you feel sure that our religion is false and that Jesus was not the Son of God.
I am not at all sure of it, Stephen said. He is more like a son of God than a son of Mary.
And is that why you will not communicate? Cranley asked. Because you are not sure of that too, because you feel that the host, too, may be the body and blood of the Son of God and not a wafer of bread. And because you fear that it may be.
Yes, Stephen said quietly. I feel that, and I also fear it.
I see, Cranley said.
Stephen, struck by his tone of closure, reopened the discussion at once by saying, I fear many things. Dogs, horses, firearms, the sea, thunderstorms, machinery, the country roads at night.
But why do you fear a bit of bread?
I imagine, Stephen said, that there is a malevolent reality behind those things I say I fear.
Do you fear then, Cranley asked, that the God of the Roman Catholics would strike you dead and damn you if you made a sacrilegious communion?
The God of the Roman Catholics could do that now, Stephen said. I fear more then that the chemical action which would be set up in my soul by a false homage to a symbol behind which are massed 20 centuries of authority and veneration.
Would you, Cranley asked, in extreme danger, commit that particular sacrilege, for instance, if you lived in the penal days?
I cannot answer for the past, Stephen replied. Possibly not.
Then, said Cranley, you do not intend to become a Protestant.
I said that I had lost the faith, Stephen answered, but not that I had lost self-respect. What kind of liberation would that be to forsake an absurdity which is logical and coherent to embrace one which is illogical and incoherent? They had walked on towards the township of Pembroke, and now, as they went on slowly along the avenues, the trees and the scattered lights in the villas soothed their minds. The air of wealth and repose diffused about them seemed to comfort their neediness. Behind a hedge of laurel, a light glimmered in the window of a kitchen, and the voice of a servant was heard singing as she sharpened knives. She sang in short, broken bars. Rosie O'Grady. Cranley stopped to listen, saying, Mulier cantat. The soft beauty of the Latin word touched with an enchanting touch the dark of the evening, with a touch fainter and more persuading than the touch of music or of a woman's hand. The strife of their minds was quelled. The figure of a woman as she appears in the liturgy of the church passed silently through the darkness, a white-robed figure, small and slender as a boy and with a fallen girdle. Her voice, frail and high as a boy's, was heard intoning from a distant choir the first words of a woman which pierced the gloom and clamour of the first chanting of the Passion. Et tu cum Jesu Galileo eras. And all hearts were touched and turned to her voice, shining like a young star, shining clearer as the voice intoned the proparoxytone, and more faintly as the cadence died. The singing ceased. They went on together, Cranley repeating in strongly stressed rhythm the end of the refrain.
And when we are married, oh, how happy we'll be, for I love sweet Rosie O'Grady, and Rosie O'Grady loves me. There's real poetry for you, he said. There's real love.
He glanced sideways at Stephen with a strange smile and said, Do you consider that poetry, or do you know what the words mean? I want to see Rosie first, said Stephen.
She's easy to find, Cranley said.
His hat had come down on his forehead. He shoved it back, and in the shadow of the trees, Stephen saw his pale face, framed by the dark, and his large, dark eyes. Yes. His face was handsome, and his body was strong and hard. He had spoken of a mother's love. He felt then the sufferings of women, the weaknesses of their bodies and souls, and would shield them with a strong and resolute arm and bow his mind to them. Away then. It is time to go. A voice spoke softly to Stephen's lonely heart, bidding him go and telling him that his friendship was coming to an end. Yes, he would go. He could not strive against another. He knew his part. Probably I shall go away, he said.
Where? Cranley asked.
Where I can, Stephen said.
Yes, Cranley said. It might be difficult for you to live here now.
What is it that makes you go? I have to go, Stephen answered.
Because, Cranley continued, You need not look upon yourself as driven away if you do not wish to go, or as a heretic or an outlaw. There are many good believers who think as you do. Would that surprise you? The church is not the stone building, nor even the clergy and their dogmas. It is the whole mass of those born into it. I don't know what you wish to do in life. Is it what you told me the night we were standing outside